Interview with Duke Chapman, April 7th, 2011, in New York City by Kenneth Durr. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing. Are you a New Yorker?
I was born in Portland, Maine, but grew up in New York, in Albany, New York. Went to Williams College, graduated with a BA, and then went to New York City, Columbia University Law School, where I received a JD. Actually received an LLB, but we all got to change them to JDs once that became popular.
Ah, okay.
$25, I think it cost.
That's a pretty good deal.
At my first job, I did some clerking in the summer when I was in law school, but my first job out of law school was with the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C.
Now, I read somewhere that you had been interested in tax law.
I had been. My dad was a very accomplished tax lawyer, and one of his dear friends taught tax law at Columbia and ended up being the dean of the school for about 40 years and has written a lot of horn books. But I discovered very quickly as I went along that I didn't know enough about corporate law to do corporate tax work. And somehow I had to learn more, quicker. At least I thought so. So I went to the SEC and interviewed with Barney Woodside, who was running the corporate finance division. And he said, nice interview, but no job. So he said, go over and see Tom Meeker and Dan McCauley in the general counsel's office, which I did. And I got offered a job as a junior lawyer, G7, and worked with particularly Irv Pollack and Joe Levin for a year and a half, and writing briefs, researching briefs. I did manage to one day, because our general counsel became ill at the last minute, they sent me. The only thing I ever argued in court was a Section 5 case in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
Well, that's pretty good.
And it was a very easy one, fortunately. And I'd written the brief, so I knew a little, but I panicked. It was a panicky feeling starting out in the courtroom.
Yeah, so but you did all right, huh?
I froze, but I unfroze in time. And then the legal assistant to one of the commissioners, Jim Sargent from New York, left. And Jim offered me the job to be his legal assistant, which I did until, I guess it was the fall of 59. And then I was offered a job to come to New York with the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay. Now, when you were working as a staff attorney,
I guess
is the name. Now, is that in the general counsel's office?
Yes, under the general counsel's office.
What was your general day-to-day like? What were your responsibilities?
Responsibilities were to work on cases, to help to work them up, to do legal research, to write preliminary briefs. And any time we needed a citation, we'd go to Irv Pollack, who had memorized every brief in the federal court system, and most of the opinions in memory. He's a fabulous guy. I don't know if you had a chance to talk to him.
I haven't had a chance to meet him.
Oh, man. He's still existing and practicing law in Washington, just formed a firm with another guy. But he was there. He is the longest tenured person I could think of and knows everything. And everyone. He'd be a fabulous guy for you to interview.
Yeah. Was Dave Ferber in there when you were there?
Dave was there, yes. Dave was there. And I can't remember the name of the market. Reg was still. Anyway. So day to day, we'd work on briefs, we'd work on cases.
And you got to argue one once.
I was still too green. They wouldn't even have send me to argue a motion. And I get an argument in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which I thought was kind of funny. So, I still remember the judges' names. I mean, it's been printed forever.
Well, what were they?
Waterman, Hinks, and Lombard. Waterman, Hinks, and, oh, my God. I've forgotten the third one for the moment. I'll remember before we get through.
All right.
Lombard was the chief judge that day.
So now it must have been pretty interesting working closely with one of the commissioners.
It was. Every day we would he would have a docket of materials that were going to be gone over in the morning in commission meetings. And my commissioner would hand that to me on the high. He lived 20 minutes beyond where I did, which was not a good idea, but I found out too late. And we'd get to my house, and he'd say, "Here, you go through this tonight. Tell me what you think for tomorrow." So I'd get home with a stack of things, and there'd be filings under the Electrical Utility Act and the Holding Act and all these things, boring as could be. So I had to go through them, and then we would review it the next morning.
On the train or in the office?
Come back in the office. Say, what do you think?
Yeah.
He had this little old Morris Minor he'd had forever. It was always an exciting ride to and from work. But I didn't have any commuting costs as a result.
How about that?
He was a very, very nice person and a good lawyer. Taught at the University of Virginia Law School. Went back to New York after his commissionership. Partner in a New York law firm.
Did he have areas that he tended to focus on more than others? Or
well, we had a chairman who had been the Massachusetts regulator of utilities, so nobody else really focused on. And that was the longest, most boring boilerplate. You know, Ned Gadsby, who was the chairman, would say, when he'd look at the filing, he'd say, "Look at this map of the New England electric system. You know that this power plant here should be a half an inch over there." So I think all the commissioners figured that what could they add to his knowledge? They all learned about the Public Utility Holding Company Act. The big focus while I was there was illegal distributions, Section 5 cases out of Canada and various other places and within the United States of pretty junky securities, Canadian mining stuff. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of Florida promoters who were doing a lot of that stuff, so there was a lot of that going on. Reviewing the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ filings. Whenever there was a fee change, it had to be filed, and the commission would give them a red light or green light on the filing, and they'd go ahead or they'd have to come and do some more explaining. And that was back in the day when the world thought the New York Stock Exchange was exempt from the antitrust laws.
Right.
And because all the trades took place in New York City, and they cleared in New York City. And that was subsequently turned around, and I was there at the New York Stock Exchange, responsible for legal, government, and civic affairs when it was turned around.
Hmm.
So who do I see one day but my old boss or Pollock coming at me?
Yeah, I'm sure you probably got that a lot.
But not that often.
Any other highlights from the SEC years?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Those were the major things that, there were always all the corporate filings, corporate underwritings. And all of those documents had to be reviewed, and legal assistants were given the task, which is pretty good education, as a matter of fact. And there would be people down arguing for their point of view under the various acts.
Now, would you have been in there when the Amex was having all their problems?
I was in New York. And
okay.
In fact, my boss went over to be the CEO at the Amex. My boss at the New York Stock Exchange, a fellow named Ted Etherington, mm-hmm. went over to the Amex to become the new chairman and to try and lead it out of the wilderness.
Well, let's take you over to the New York Stock Exchange then. How did that opportunity come up?
Well, when the senior management of the exchange would come down, they would go around and visit all the commissioners. Jim Sargent was from New York, so they probably had more in common with him. It's been time when they really had a filing to come down and talk about it. And my boss included me in all those meetings, so I got to meet these people. And then one day they came around, he wasn't there, and they had some things they needed to get done, so I volunteered and got them done for them. And that all ended up in when I say got them done, they were procedural things in the SEC. And so I just got a call one day, and Etherington said, I'd like to talk to you. Came in and said, the boss wants to know whether you'd like to come to work with us as my assistants. So I thought about it, checked with my bride how she felt about moving to New York. She was from Birmingham, Alabama. And so we moved to New York and took that job in the fall of 59. And Ted left, I'm going to guess it was in 61. He was vice president in charge of civic government and legal affairs. He left for the Amex, and they decided that I would take his job. So I became house counsel and responsible for legal government. And they added civic affairs.
Okay, so you went in first as an assistant to Etherington?
To Etherington, yes.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about him, because he's come up a great deal, but I've never spoken with anyone who worked with him.
Very, very smart guy. Very, very organized. And very extremely nice person. He and his wife, Kathy, were two of the nicest people I've ever met. He understood almost instinctively the business. But I think that would have been true in any business he got involved in. He was just one of those people who would get a grasp of things, and he'd think he was a wonderful conceptual thinker. And he would think through the problems. And we would sit and talk about the problems and the answers, and I'd think about them, come up with my answers, and he'd tell me why they were wrong, and then he would tell me his answers, and we'd agree they were right. It wasn't that much that way, but we'd have great discussions. He was very open. He was very, he wasn't dictatorial in the way he approached things. So we would discuss it. He was, everybody loved him. The members did, and they respected him, I should say. Everybody respected him and liked him. And I think over at the Amex, when he came in, he got greeted very favorably, and we did a really good job.
Yeah, that would have been one of the reasons he was tapped to go over there.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
Do you remember what some of the things that, some of the issues were? I mean, I'm sure there was the day-to-day.
The New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm. In those early years.
Well, the biggest ones that come to mind were the fact the New York Stock Exchange had a very strong regulatory hand that reached into its members' affairs way beyond what they were doing in New York City, and out through the correspondent network of firms, of non-member firms that worked with them. And one application that came in for First Boston to have a correspondent in Texas, the Department of the Market Regulation Department, member firm department, told First Boston they couldn't have that company as a correspondent. They couldn't be a correspondent in New York Stock Exchange because our investigation had shown that they were not of the caliber for the New York Stock Exchange. There was a lot of that around. And the reasons they turned it down were kind of ad hominem rumors. Mm. Which no one ever proved to be true, and which First Boston said, ridiculous. Mm. But they raised the issue with the commission and raised the issue, and that brought up the issue of the New York Stock Exchange being exempt from the antitrust laws. That the New York Stock Exchange had gone far beyond. Not only didn't it give due process, but it was doing business outside on interstate basis. Mm-hmm. And there was an old case of the Supreme Court, which I can't remember.
Was this the Silver
Exchange
case?
Exchange Buffet, I think was the name of it.
Hmm? Okay. It sounds like the Silver case, too, where they yanked a broker's stock ticker.
The exchange yanked
a stock ticker.
So that raised the whole question, and the mm-hmm. SEC considered it, and they consulted with, I'm sure, Justice Department. And there was a rule of 390 on the New York Stock Exchange, which said that members could not change trade with non-members without approval, and that all transactions had to be done through the member firm on the New York Stock Exchange in any listed stock, wherever it was listed, otherwise didn't matter. And so I had a visit one day. Keith Funston, who was president of the exchange, had a visit one day from a delegation from the SEC, Gene Rotberg, Fred Moss, who, by the way, had been a classmate of my law school.
Oh.
And he went to the SEC. We were there at the same time. And we played in the finals, and I beat him in the SEC annual tennis tournament. and Herb Pollack. And I was called into Keith's office after they'd been there a while. He said, "You got to go meet with these folks, get our outside counsel. It sounds like we've got a problem to work on." Keith was had been president of Tufts, and he was not a lawyer, and he taught me not to use prepositions at the end of a sentence and would edit every memo I wrote. Great guy, great boss. So we met, and we spent months and months and months working on Rule 390 and wrote a Rule 390B, which is the first crack in the antitrust protection that the exchange thought they had. And so we put the new rule in, and it gave an opportunity for competitive. If the exchange couldn't match, and the specialists had to have a special opportunity to match the market elsewhere.
It provided a window of time,
a second opportunity if they looked at the order, made a bidder an offer, and it was lower than somewhere else, it gave them a window to come back and get a second guess shot at it. It was a small expansion of the rule,
yeah. But
it was the beginning.
Hmm. Now, was most of the initiative on this coming from the SEC?
Yes, totally from the SEC.
Okay.
And the members didn't like it at all. Some of them could see where it was going, which was a full-scale assault on the right of the New York Stock Exchange to fix commissions. And that was a big, long, drawn-out battle. The lawyers lined up. And the SEC said, no more red light, green light. From now on, you're going to have to submit your changes on commissions that are charged to the exchange, by the exchange.
What red light, green light? Explain that to me.
We'd do a filing, and someone would call back and say, green light, go ahead and implement it, or red light, you got to come talk to us. What it also did is it opened the door for, of all people, Bernie Madoff and his firm. It created the beginning of the third market, because we could not fix commissions. The over-the-counter firms could trade listed stocks away from the exchange, and took away the right of the exchange to fix commissions on anything other than their members. And those commissions would go through a very serious regulatory review any time they were to be changed. So it really took the old private club. While I was there, that was the most important things going on, and opened it up. But the world, though, there was no longer antitrust exemption, regulating commission rates, and that the SEC deciding fees, and it was the beginning of the end for the old boy system.
Hmm.
Or maybe it was the end of the middle of the end of the old boy system.
Right, there you go.
And I guess it was not a competitive environment. NASDAQ traders traded NASDAQ over-the-counter stocks, and the good big capitalized stocks came on the New York Stock Exchange, or mid-level went to the Amex.
Right. So you see 390B as really being the beginning.
Well, I see it was the first chink in the armor.
Yeah.
And then it went on from there.
Okay.
And
yeah,
where we are today, you know, which is wide open competition. Actually, that period I was there, it opened the door. Those decisions opened the door. Subsequent decisions that opened the door to two firms that created the third market on New York listed stocks. Mm-hmm. It was Wieden and Company and Madoff. And they made very competitive markets. But they got to pick and choose where our specialist got assigned stocks, and they had a responsibility to commit their capital in times of descending markets. And so that the New York Stock Exchange specialist would say, oh, these guys have a big advantage. This is unfair. And the guys over there would say, hey, you've got the specialist book. You see all the customers' orders, and there was a big debate, but they took a good chunk of the market away.
Yeah, yeah.
And built very, very successful dealer firms.
Right.
Madoff was very successful.
Yeah, creative. And Don Wieden did okay until 75 or so.
They were very good in the bond market, too. Wieden was good in the bond market, muni bond market particularly, but Don and Alan was his older brother and they created the firm, and they did very well.
This would have been the time that the special study came out, too, which took a real hard look at everything.
Well, that's what led into...
Okay, so this was part of that initiative.
Off of 390B, off of the attack on Rule 390, mm-hmm. triggered an inquiry, which turned into the special study, about pricing and all of that. And so I dealt a lot with Gene and Fred Moss, Ralph Saul, one of the great guys, and was Ralph Saul. So is Gene, so is Freddie. Freddie died last year. But we were friends forever.
The commission rate issue, was that being discussed at this point?
That was really discussed because institutional firms got better commissions than retail traders. Retail traders had fixed rates, but over a certain value of the stock, value of transactions, the rates could be negotiated. So the institutions, and that was one of the issues being looked at, a big mm-hmm. important one in the special study, and came out of that you couldn't have preferential rates.
Right. One of the things I understand is they were sort of negotiated through back doors, like with give backs and things like that. So
exactly.
It wasn't a transparent system.
No, it wasn't transparent at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you work pretty closely with Keith Funston?
Very, very, yeah.
Was your sort of a, it sounds like it would have been a liaison role where you're sort of lobbying and talking to the government.
I did a lot. I remember when I came back from a trip to Washington. I went to Washington 1.5 times a week over a five-year period because I was commission responsibilities, tax legislation responsibilities, and New York State and other state legislative responsibilities, and then the civic and governmental and dealing with member firms. But my favorite story about Keith is I came back from one of these trips, and he said, "Who did you see?" And so I rattled off about 20 names. I'd only been gone a day and a half. Members of Congress. He said, "Well, do you know my old friend Leverett Saltonstall from Boston, Senator Saltonstall?" I said, "No." He says, "I don't want you to ever come back in this office unless you can tell me you know that you have met every member of Congress." And I said, "Keith, Saltonstall's not on any of our committees that we care about. He's a wonderful guy by reputation. I haven't met him. But just if I concentrate on the committees, get to know those people is a full-time job." He says, "I don't care. I want you to know every one of them." He never asked me whether I had gotten to know anybody. But that was Funston. And the members all called him a Boy Scout. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. He didn't swear on issues. His view was, own your share of American business to the investing public. He brought that theme.
Right.
And that was for the Boys Club that always kind of poo-pooed that kind of thing. It was a dramatic change in the business. Merrill Lynch went out and built a giant customer base of retail investors. And he made that major contribution to the exchange.
Yeah. And something else, a pretty sizable event, was when the Ira Haupt incident took place.
Mm-hmm.
And Funston would have been, he would have made the decision to pay back those customers.
Yes, that was a board decision.
Okay.
It was taken to the board by Keith, or he had the department member firms take it to the board. I remember that day vividly. I got a call from the fellow who was head of the member firm, Bob Bishop. And Bob said, "Duke, we're supposed to go over to Ira Haupt. They've got a terrible problem. They're going broke. And people are coming in and demanding their securities. The lobby's crowded." So I said, "Okay, Bob, grab two of our guards." We had uniform guards, pistols on their hips. "And we'll go over there." And we got there and got our way through this mob of people. The vault was open. People were walking in, taking certificates, and leaving. So we stopped that. And there was a guy coming out, and the guard said, "Wait a minute." He had some bundle of securities under his arm. And Bob said, What are you doing with those certificates?" He said, "Ira Haupt owes us these certificates. I'm from one of the big banks, and I came, they sent me to bring them back."
They didn't mess around.
That was an exciting time. But that decision was a wise one, I think, in terms of the integrity and the reputation of the market mechanisms.
Was it understood that that would set a precedent?
Everyone was afraid it would set a precedent. And then, of course, people would say, "Yeah, I won't say precedent. Next time we'll decide that, you know, we do it with a precedent."
Okay, well, we talked a little bit about the special study. It would seem to me that you probably would have been involved a great deal of the time reacting to what was coming out in 63, 64.
Absolutely.
Anything else that we should talk about from your time at the exchange?
No, it was a time of great change. No, there's nothing, as I've thought back on it, that would be even anyway comparable to those events that were going on. You know, we worked on changes in the tax law, and we were successful sometimes and unsuccessful others, but our real focus was a special study. And it took up all the energy. Because once a special study got going, every department had to totally review and rethink what they did. There were a lot of memos written back then.
Yeah. Did you have a time frame in which you had to respond?
There was usually a time frame, but we were usually within that time frame.
Yeah.
You know, they'd like to hear back in the next 90 days or whatever it was.
Right. How'd you get the opportunity then to go to Shearson Hamel?
Well, I had been invited to go to the quarterly meetings of the Association of Stock Exchange Firm because I had fairly quickly was put in charge of member affairs, which offended Bob Bishop in the membership department, but he didn't have the personality to go out and because the member firms wanted to hear about what was going on in taxes and the SEC. So I went to those meetings, and then I was asked if I could be on their legislative committees or at least give them reports, and I did that. And those meetings were attended by the heads of the member firms, and they did them in various cities. They brought their wives. Accidentally, was when they were running the Kentucky Derby, there'd be a meeting in Louisville. But they were very interesting, and he got to know personally all the people. And I liked Bob Van Tuyl from Shearson a lot. He was probably the most versed in computers of any head of any member of firm at that time. And he had been a top IBM salesman before. So I decided in 1966, I went to Keith and I said, I'm going to be thinking of going to member firms. I had an offer from Bache & Company. Harold Bache wanted me to come over and be his assistant, but everyone would have had their knives out for a Harold Bache assistant. That's why he didn't have one. And he said, well, I said, I've done all these things, and I know how to do them, and I think I've done a good job, but I want to have another challenge. And he said, go talk to Ed Gray. Ed Gray was the executive vice president of the exchange. Been there a long time, run the membership firm's department before. Wonderful guy. So I went in, and I was talking to Ed and saying, that's what I'm thinking about, maybe doing something else. He said, well, you got a decision to make. You should know that no one from the staff will ever be president of this exchange. He says, the members look at staff people differently. And the member, he said, I could never be president, no matter how good a job you do, if your staff could ever be president. So he said, put that in your pipe and smoke a bit while you're thinking about things. We had a good talk. And then I went over to Pace Institute across the river. And they had a program where they put you through testing to see what your aptitudes were for business. And mine came back that I would be a very good dentist or forest ranger.
You were in the wrong place.
I should have gotten my money back. Anyway, I just spent a lot of time thinking about it, talking about it, talked to my dad about it a lot. And I had several offers from firms like Hornblower, and once the board members knew I was thinking of going. And Van Tile offered me a job to come over and be a junior vice president and learn the business. So I did. Keith had tried to sweeten my position by adding the title of being in charge of long-range planning. So as a result of all that was going on, I came in one day, and this is when I really made my decision to go, and I said, Keith, I've been working on long-range planning ideas. And he looked at me and said, hey, we don't have time for that.
So what was Shearson's reputation in the business?
Very high retail firm reputation. They were the firm that Research built. The founder, Murray Sapani, was a research guy. And he did research in the way at the beginning that other people didn't. He'd go to Pittsburgh and sit outside with a clicker in his hand and count the smokestacks that were working and those that weren't. Basic research. But he was a wonderful guy, and he built a firm around research. And they built a retail system that made it the E.F. Hutton, Hayden Stone, Shearson, Payne Weber, and Merrill Lynch were really the retail networks. And it was a good business. It was very broad-based, you know. But our guys were out there selling the success of our research. And then we had commodities and, you know, all the other stuff over
right,
the counter.
Right. How long did it take you to learn the business?
I never really learned it all the way. I had a chance as I went along to get involved in every part of the business and know something about every part of the business. The retail business, I think, I got to know very well. I ended up running it. I think we had 1,000 branch offices then, and all across the country. And I managed that retail business until I became president and CEO of the firm.
Okay.
Bob Van Tile. I developed a brain tumor. He knew he was going to. They had to make some plans.
So you would have just sort of gotten up to speed when the back office problems started to creep up on you.
Oh, the back office problems. And we never had back office problems because we had two giant controlled data, 55, I think it was 5,500, 5,600, two of the early boxes. And so all of our, and of course those are batch processing after trade and got beyond that. But our guys would be finished at 5:30 in the evening every day. The pot was right. So they would go upstairs, another firm, our senior guys in the back office would go upstairs to help out another firm. And we had Hayden Stone and Goodbody, and there were a bunch of us at our back offices there. And I won't say what firm it was, but maybe it was typical of a lot of them. They were so far behind that even with our help, you know, the people were helping out, every day the number of failed trades, unmatched trades, grew. You get rid of, you cleaned up 1,500 a night, and the next morning, the next night, you know, next morning, day's work, you come back, and you had more than you had to start with the night before. And securities had to be physically signed to be transferred so that we didn't have a bookkeeping entry system. So the whole transfer system was pieces of paper, certificates moving around the street. Customers had to sign for the transfer.
Did this brokerage put your people from Shearson on some kind of retainership to help them? Is that how
they just did it as friends.
Okay.
And they would... One day one of our guys went up, and there was some guy back in the cage, and they didn't have the signed certificates, but they wanted to complete the transfers, so they put it on the floor and rubbed their foot over where the signature should be and then sign the name of the customer. I mean, it was a legitimate trade. Everything's fine, but they didn't have that customer signature. So one of the things that came out of that was another one of my wonderful chores at the opportunities at the exchange. There was an amendment to the Section 9 of the Commercial Code, which said it had been approved by the commissioners but had to be adopted by the state legislators, that you could transfer the ownership in securities on a bookkeeping entry basis. So my job was to go out and get that bill adopted in state legislatures. And that was an eye-opening experience. Because those state legislatures are very primitive. They're a lot better now, but I go in and I testify in Arizona, and my testimony would be over, and the chairman of the committee would come and say to me, "Okay, Mr. Chapman," he says, "you know, we don't understand what you're talking about. Our folks know cattle, they know land, they know all those sort of things." He says, "You go down the street to Arizona Public Service and talk to the chairman. He'll understand your story. And then tell him to now come talk to me, and we'll take care of it." So that's what I do. And lo and behold, it would pass in Arizona. Huh. What the head of Arizona Public Service did to get it passed, we'll never know. But there were no committee hearings. There were no records of the hearings and the testimony. I did have one member of the committee, and state to be unnamed, who said to me, "Mr. Chapman, we don't understand you talking about runners running around the street in this part of the world. Runners are guys that bring illegal booze from their stills. And that's what runners are. We don't really get what you're doing, but if you would give me $1,000 a committee member in cash, you got it." I mean, those are the extremes.
Okay, sure.
And then in a lot of states, it went through the way it should, you know.
Okay.
But it was kind of, all of a sudden, I had 48 states I had to get state legislation in. And they didn't all meet on the same year every year. Some of them met once every 2 years. And
So this was in the mid-60s you were doing this?
Yes.
Okay. To lay the groundwork.
First half of the 60s.
To lay the groundwork for the clearing.
Yeah, and then my successor had to keep on going. Now, the best hire I ever made was an assistant I brought into the exchange. I forgot to mention that. He was the legal commissioner, securities commissioner in Illinois, and his name was Don Calvin. And Don came in to be my assistant. When I left, there was a great brouhaha. We're going to go out and hire some fancy this and that. And I went to the board members and I said, you're never going to find anyone as good or committed as Don. And they ended up picking him. Mm-hmm. And he went on to a fabulous career.
Yeah.
And so I was at Cheerson. I went first with just giving projects. The over-the-counter department, the quotation system was totally overboard. They couldn't get into the quotes. So I said, I'll go back and be a quote clerk. So I went back, and for a week I had a phone. And you had to get a quote from two different firms before you could send that quote out in terms of what the current market was.
Right.
And I did that. And the quotes came in, and they were going in boxes, and they were being unanswered. And so, but having spent a week at it, I went to the guy who ran the department. I think I know, can help solve your problem. He said, what's that? I said, Hawaiian Airlines, that was a hot stock then. If you quoted it about to the system once every half hour, you would reduce your quotes by, I counted them up over in the week, by this much per day just on that one stock. I said, if we can take the 100 stocks that are most actively being asked for quotes and put them on a list and have some person quote them every half hour, you won't be overflowing. And so all of a sudden, it solved the problem.
Fewer phone calls.
Yeah, I was brilliant. Everyone kept saying, oh, my God, look what that guy thought of. Well, look what he thought of.
Well, you talked about Cheerson being a retail.
Yes.
Real big in the retail. And in this is a period where you're seeing the rise of some firms that are doing big blocks of mm-hmm. business as well.
Yes.
Was there a point at which that those two sorts of functions came out of whack, that became a liability for Cheerson?
Not really, because our retail stayed predominant. How we got paid, when the fixed commissions at the institutional level went away, and we had to negotiate. The firms that had a big institutional business really got hurt. We had a not really big institutional business. We had an institutional business. They like our research. But so that for us, it wasn't as much of a hit. And on the retail side, the unfixing of commissions ended up with commissions not being, didn't spend, it wasn't the death knell. Commission stayed high enough. But some firms, it was really killed their business.
Yeah. In the 70s, things started to slow down, too.
Yeah. Now, we were going through a period. So by the time I left, when I think of Cheerson, there's a phase that runs up till 1973, 4. The market was in terror, it had been bad for a long time. The Dow Jones was 800. Firms were merging. Stock Exchange had a special committee which called firms on the carpet because their capital wasn't adequate, and they set a much tougher capital target than the prior and the SEC. And so your capital ratio had to be a 10 to 1 or better, and if you were over that, and had previously been higher than that. Most of the firms are like ours in that we had been partnerships,
right,
and our earnings would be in preferred stock. And every security of the company was callable by the customer on a six-month or a one-year notice. So things went wrong, the capital could just flee and we couldn't stop. So everyone incorporated. And when they did the same thing all over again. And they had preferred stock and common stock, and they had those provisions and all of those, so they didn't solve the problem. So it was a time of great stress in the industry, and it was for Cheerson. I can remember being called up before that committee and being told that we had to get our ratio under 10 to 1, or we need to come back and tell them how it was going to be get under there, or we would be closed down. And the number one way to get under there was to close branches. And, of course, if you started closing branches, then the rumors would spread. And so I set out to find a firm to merge with, rather than run the risk of having a run on the bank, People Bank. And we were doing interim things, which would keep ourselves headed towards 10 to 1. I have to go back every week to the committee. Those are fun visits. And so I went and talked to Reynolds and Company, and went and talked to Payne Weber and all of those people. Reynolds is not in that group, but they were the other wirehouse. And the head of Reynolds, who was a dear friend of mine, said, "Duke, you know, I don't think it's important we do a deal, but we'd sure help pick the bones." And then we went to Payne Weber, and we were within a day of a merger. And our board voted it, and their board met the next morning. And they had one big shareholder who wasn't part of their team. And he'd made a big capital contribution when they needed it. And he said, "No, I don't want to do it. It's going to dilute my position so much that I won't have any effect in the new firm." So I got a call saying, "Oops, we couldn't get it done." Of course, all the comedians in the firms were trying to think up the name for the new firm. And one guy came up with the name Sheer Pain.
Which it would have been for a little while there.
Yeah. And then subsequently, I met with Sandy Weil, who ran CBWL Hayden Stone. They had acquired Hayden Stone, the remains of Hayden Stone, the other, the grand old names.
Right.
And we talked about merging our businesses in the spring of 1974, and he knew we were in trouble. We worked and worked and worked on it, and we decided that if we were going to take the average daily volume of the New York Stock Exchange, which was in April of that year, 14,000 shares a day, and we were going to look at our two firms and see if we could put together a firm that made money in that environment. And if we could, we were going to go ahead and merge the firms. So we came up with one that did. It cost a lot of bodies, and the majority of more of them came from my firm than came from his. We were bigger, and we were in more trouble. We were in
but
trouble.
But you had all the retail branches.
They had some too. They had a fair number.
Okay.
And a nice European branch of offices. So on Memorial Day weekend, we decided we would go ahead and do it. We spent the summer putting it together, closed it in September of that year, and became Shearson Hayden Stone.
Okay.
Some of the press treated us not the way I would have hoped for. One of the headlines was, "Does one and one really make a half?" Talking about our merger. I think that was the Wall Street Journal. And then Business Week had a headline and a little article talking about a merger, and the comment was, "The only difference between this merger and the Titanic is they had a piano in the Titanic." So you had to hold 1,000 salesmen hand, and
yeah.
we all took the road. That was part of the plan. We were at the branches, all the branches, talking to the troops, and I think we kept 85% of our sales force, which was on a combination. Anyone who can do that was usually... I would think out of that, we then acquired 7 member firms between 74 and 81.
Wow, okay.
And integrated them all and ended up with $980 million market value of shares of American Express and returned to our firm. Sandy and I were co-chairmen, except I learned quickly that they're the co-chairman, somebody's the chairman, and it wasn't me.
Right. Well, he was a pretty enterprising guy.
He was great. And, our market cap on that September day when the firm officially became Shearson Hayden Stone, traded on American Stock Exchange, was under $10 million. So it was a great run. A lot of people made a lot of money. all those acquisitions. We gave preferred stock to people, which was convertible at prices that no one thought we'd ever get to, and those who didn't, those who kept it made a lot of money. It was a good deal for them. When we joined American Express, Sandy went over to American Express. He wanted to become the CEO. And I left with him because I didn't want to work for the guy who took his place. And I told him and the guy that and why, but I won't go into that here.
Yeah.
And I then became the vice chairman of the International Bank. And my job was to build a private client business on top of the bank's travel and traveler's check business.
What's a private client business?
That's private banking. You get people who would come and put their money in Switzerland, where we had two offices, or Singapore, or we had offices around the world.
Okay.
And you went to the wealthiest people you could find and get in front of and can try and convince them to use your banking facilities, which brought with it privacy. Most countries had serious exchange controls. Many people got around that by creating Swiss companies. They would sell the product to their own Swiss company, who would then reprice it and sell it to the world in a different state in the Swiss company. And so now that money was out of the country.
Right.
There were all sorts of ways to get around the exchange controls. People who didn't want their recently divorced wives to know where their assets were. There were people who ran foreign governments who wanted some of the money offshore, and usually a lot of it. And so it was an interesting business.
Now, you were in London when you were doing this, is
that
right?
Yeah, I went to London. And built a team in New York for the first year and a product, and then went to London, and I marketed for the next 4 years. Around the world, every month except August, at least once a month around the world. I became chairman of 9 Amex 50% owned banks in places you wouldn't want to go and some you would. Nigeria, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Egypt. Anyway, it was a lot of those places. So that was a great for a young guy with total energy and an understanding wife. It was terrific because in August we would go to the south of France and stay in a lovely hotel and entertain our clients who all came from around the world. So we were entertaining Greek shippers and Arab potentates, and it was kind of fun. At the end of the summer, we'd have to give a party outdoors at the sporting club, black tie for 1,500 people. And our board of directors, strangely enough, would fly from the States to be with our clients for that gathering and that weekend. So it was a great experience. And then one day, I was just back from Lagos, Nigeria, which was a horrible place. And it's probably gotten worse, I don't know. And I got a call from the headhunter, Russ Reynolds, in Chicago, New York. Said, how would you like to be the chairman of the CBOE? I had been a board member before I went to London, so I understood that. I had been responsible for Shears and Hayden's commodities business for a good long time. And Shearson, when I was running it, had the biggest share of the retail put-and-call business when it was an over-the-counter business. So it didn't take me long after checking with my bride to say yes. And so in September of 86, I started there, left American Express, and was CBOE for the next 11 and a half years. And when I arrived, 86 was the biggest year in the history of the exchange. It was a booming year. 87, a booming year. And then came the crash.
Yeah. You had been on. You'd been on the board at the CBOE earlier.
Yeah, so I knew all the players and.
Yeah, and then you went away for a while. Were you surprised when you came back?
I had to go away because I was out of the country, so
right.
I stepped off the board.
Right.
And I was with the bank, so I couldn't, once I went to American school.
Right. I just want to get a sense of whether you saw a great deal of change. Because
when I came back, the CBA, I watched the whole thing as our put and call business shifted to exchange business, the over the counter business went on the exchange. We would make a tremendous amount of money in that business, and the margins were cut for us. But the volume increased so dramatically because there was a market other than a negotiated put and call market, which gave, you know, there were market maker crowds, and some of them pretty competitive and some less competitive, but it was a better market. And the firms then put out a lot more publicity and education and training and research. So the thing grew while I was gone. It started in 74, and when I went overseas, it was 81 or 82. And so when I came back, it had changed. The volumes had skyrocketed. The crowds were immense. My first day on the job, having signed a contract with the then chairman, CEO, Wally Auk, we went down to the floor, not really, it was to the control room that overlooked the trading pit for the S&P 100 OEX. And it had 200 traders in there, all tiered up, hanging from the rafters. So Wally says, I'd like you to meet the new CEO, Duke Chapman. All of a sudden, you know, these guys, you think you're a football game, Duke. It was that kind of atmosphere on the floor.
These were not your New York Stock Exchange type
things. No. Yeah. And when I used to bring people who were in town from the various congressional people. I brought Bill Bradley to the fourth floor. All of a sudden, in that pit, they started going, dollar bill, dollar bill. And he walked up through the crowd, and they loved it. It was a different kind of place.
Yeah, and you led right into one of the first things I wanted to talk about was, you know, Walter Auk had some issues with the floor traders.
Yes.
And there was a lot of tension for a long time there, particularly at the end. Tell me a little bit about how you approached that thorny situation.
The exchange had been run by committees of the members. And the executives of the exchange were served at their sufferance. And they weren't driving change. Everyone liked what they had, and they didn't want change. The member firms, on the other hand, were saying, look, you got to change. Your spreads are too wide. Your commissions are too high. You know, all the things you would expect the customers to be saying. And Wally listened to that, I think agreed with it. He was frustrated, it had been, about not having the power a CEO would normally have. He was president. So he met with the SEC, and they came up with a new plan to restructure the CBOE's board and governance structure, which was to make Wally chairman of the board and president, and to give him much more power than he had before. So that was what the frictions were about. Secondly, Wally didn't like to go to the floor. When I was CBOE chairman, I went to the floor every day. I told my assistant and I told my bride, I said, every morning, first thing you see me, you say, did you go to the floor yesterday? And I would eat lunch in the members' firm's cafeteria, and didn't take long for all these young people to know that my name was Duke, not Mr. Chapman. And I used to tell them, well, even my children, friends, don't call me Mr. Chapman, call me Duke. And so I built a very good rapport, but Wally didn't go out of his way to do that. And he was sort of in conflict with his board members and his committee chairman. And that's what produced their looking for a new chairman.
Tell me a little bit about
he believed in the right things, but he hadn't established the kind of relationships to bring them about without cutting his own throat.
Right. Gary Leahy would have been one of the big representatives of the people.
Gary.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Gary was a market maker. He was head of He was in one of the crowds, and he was his lead market maker. And he became a board member, M Firm board member. And Gary was one of the great proponents of no change. And because the majority of the board were market makers, and that was one of the things the SEC changed, they could call the shots, they could stop change. I remember when some of the real changes were happening when I was there, having guys come to me from the floor and say, look, Duke, put this off for 2 years. It's going to screw up my business. All I need is 2 more years and I'll retire and you go ahead and do it. I mean, that was so symptomatic of the kind of thinking. When we first brought electronic order delivery, there was a great resistance. Everyone liked the idea of having runners come out with their orders and have them hand signal from the pits, from pits back to the... they fought that. Most every innovation that happened, there was a resistance from the four people because they were afraid it was going to change their business.
Tell me a little bit about that's one of the things shaping CBOE. The other one, of course, you mentioned is the OEX.
Yes.
This is a very large percentage of the business going
on. It was.
So I would assume that kind of really molded the organization.
Well, it was the only index. Remember, there weren't any other exchanges, and then the ones that came on were modest. Amex became the biggest competitor, but CBOE had 70% of the business when I left, down from some other higher number previously.
Yeah.
And the other exchanges were around the edges. The Amex got competitive, very, some of them pretty competitive near the end of my stay, the latter part of it.
You would think there would have been a great deal of attention paid to the OEX and making sure that worked.
I wonder if that might have happened at the expense
of something else.
Well, the key to OEX was that that's where the members could make money. That's where the volume was. That's where the public interest was. That was where institutions could hedge their portfolios. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any other place. I remember after I'd been there, I guess it was after the 89 mini crash, but we developed the S&P 500 index, and I can remember going to a top trading, the head of a trading firm named Henry Jarecki in New York, and met with him, with his right-hand guy, who they were Timber Hill, and his right-hand guy has created the biggest low-cost professional firm in the business now. And I said, gee, we want this S&P index to work. We need to have some market makers in the crowd. He said, okay, we'll put someone in. Then I went to the two other biggest trading firms and said, give me somebody. And we had four market makers to start and a little teeny crowd. And now it's passed OEX dramatically. It's minis are traded it's the biggest contract on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So it grew up in the beginning of the electronic age, and OEX was kind of the vehicle for the open outcry traders.
Okay.
When we went electronic, there's still a pretty good crowd there, but it's even bigger at SPX now. But when we went electronic, there were a tremendous number of guys. I mean, I'm saying to one guy, well, what if we get you 2 years? What are you going to do after that? He said, well, I'll go back to doing what I did before. I used to repair cars. The Financial Times had an article after they went electronic in the futures exchange in London, saying 70% of the floor brokers have gone back to their home counties and are washing cars and doing the other things they're qualified to do.
Yeah.
Huh. These are smart guys. I mean, they were intellectually smart. They're math whizzes.
Yeah.
And
It's a very, very different kind of skill. Well, let's talk about one of the things that precipitated all that IT, which was the 87, October 87.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that day.
That day? Well, that day, that Friday before, I was on the golf course with my vice chairman and our two biggest traders, Blair Hull and John Stafford. And a phone call came, and they said, the market's down 190 points or whatever it was that Friday. It was a big number. So we all left the golf course and rushed back and trying to make sure everyone is okay over the weekend. The trades are matching, and it was a big volume day. And then on Monday, the torrent hit, and we went down. Just went down. Five, I guess it was 540 points, I think it was, on the Dow, and giant volume. And our concentration at that point was trying to make sure that the clearing firms could clear the business, and market makers were matching trades, and we weren't having people who were getting bankrupted. The next morning, the market opened up, and then the next morning it opened down big. But that morning I had been with the head of Clearing Corporation, Wayne Lutheringhausen. I'd said, Wayne, we have to go over and talk to the Federal Reserve. So we waited outside the office of the chairman of the Federal Reserve at 6 a.m. He was already having his meeting. And he came out and he said, what do you guys want? He said, well, you know, if we don't get some kind of relief on the clearing, you've got firms that have not got enough money to clear all these trades. And we mentioned several of them. And he said, they all say that it's when they talk to their banker, they know that they aren't using all of their credit lines and they'll be able to clear these trades. However, the senior bankers are still asleep in New York or on their way to work, and we need help from the Federal Reserve so that the firms can go ahead and extend the credit. And so the Federal Reserve in Washington said okay and quietly made the rounds, calling the banks and saying, you know, extend the credit. We need to have you do it. We'll take the firms on their word. So that was pretty scary. And the whole system would have come ground to a stop. Clearing firms, any big clearing firm would have gummed up the whole system. And it was true over in the futures markets, too. But ours was the biggest. And then the market traded down. And at noon on Tuesday, you could walk to the floor and there wasn't a sound except for the time clocks clicking. And we had a lot of time clocks, so it was. And you went to the OAX pit and guys were all standing there looking ashen-faced. And any one of the pits, you know, you look at guys, some of them, of course, had tapped out. One of the very best traders, a good friend, he wife and three kids and a house in the suburbs, and he went bankrupt. And he resurrected himself because he's a smart guy. But, you know, that was happening in a lot of places and with a lot of customers.
So the aftermath of this, the volume goes way down.
Oh, yeah, and at noon that day, over on the Board of Trade, where they listed the Amex equivalent of the CBO, the OEX, the Amex Market Index, a guy named Blair Hull started buying in size. And everyone kept saying to Blair, who's your customer? He said, I can't tell you. I can't tell you my customer is. And he triggered a giant rally. And Blair was buying for his own account. And I said, for his firm's account, I said, Blair, why did you do it? He said, my experience gave me a feeling that this was going to be the bottom. No one was trading, everything had stopped. So I figured it was my last chance to get them at that price. And he turned the market.
What was his firm?
It was called Blair Hall.
Okay.
Now it's called Matlock Capital. He sold his firm to Goldman Sachs a number of years back for a lot of money.
So that was the beginning of the climb back up.
That was the beginning of the recovery. There were some other bad days, but that was the beginning.
And it was a long climb for, four or five years before the CBOE did the same volume.
Yeah, but you got to remember in 89 we had another bad market event, which kind of was a setback to that.
Right.
Financing fell through for a big deal, and a lot of the firms had positions. And that day, the market crashed big, not like 86, but big. And a lot of the problems that we'd seen before, we had one clearing firm that was on the brink of bankruptcy, and we had to step in. I had a board meeting on Sunday. We put up our money, and Amex put up money, and Clearing Corporation put up money to keep the firm from going out of business. We all had rescue funds.
Now, it sounds like it would have been pretty clear that there were some things that had to be done, you know, put in the requirements so that people and businesses wouldn't be so close to going out of business all the time.
Well, you would have said that, and that's true now, after Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns are gone. You only know after the fact.
Right.
And you think, that's never going to happen again. Well, what we did with the clearing firms is we did tighten up with them. And one of the things that I thought was strange, but was true, is that the free credit balances of the traders, their profits that were sitting in the clearing firm, were not segregated the way customer money was. So they were at the total risk of the firm failing. And their funds would go along with the firm's funds. So when we were looking at firms that were about to fail, they had wiped out the equity not only of the firm, but of the market makers who cleared through the firm.
Market makers. One of the bones of contention with the floor was the competing market maker setup.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was still in when you came started?
When you say competing market makers,
there were as opposed to having a specialist,
The crowd. Yeah, we had competing market makers and crowds.
Okay.
And the whole floor was that way when I came in.
Right.
And there were the kind of crowds where you'd come in with an order and eight guys would all out their best, yell their best price, and then the guy who led the way, who had the best price, would get the order and execute it. There were other pits where there was one guy who was the resident genius and he would shout out. And then the guy bringing the order would say, all right, two for you, two for you, and two for you. Four for the guy who made the price. But they were basically competitive crowds.
Right.
There were, in those competitive crowds, go-along traders, I called them, who would ride piggyback. And when I shouted six and a quarter, six and a half, he'd shout six and a quarter, six and a half. He wasn't thinking of what it should be. He'd be... And then when the order got broken up for the people who did say six and a quarter, he'd get some. But majority of them were real market makers and good market makers. And OEX was fiercely competitive.
Sure.
SPX, by the time I left, had 75 traders in the pit.
What about options that weren't as, you know, glamorous and weren't trading like those?
Well, every crowd had them. Each crowd, as the allocation committee handed out the allocations, they would look at the crowds and say, you know, these fellas have six dogs and two good ones. Maybe they ought to have another good one. This might be a good one. No one knew until after the fact. They knew. And that allocation went on. We had a lottery system going with the SEC. I call it a lottery system. They got some other name for it, where we would each put in our list of what we wanted to list new. And then someone would be picked. I don't know whether they, I can't remember whether they flipped a coin or rolled the dice or took numbers out of a hat. One exchange would start. Say, I'll take this one. And it was just like kids picking a baseball team, two baseball teams. And that offended the sensibilities of the Justice Department. And they told the SEC they didn't like that. So that was the beginning of the competition between exchanges.
Right.
That allocation system, we call it the allocation system, was done away with, and exchanges were allowed to competitive list and encouraged, basically, to competitive trade. Now, it wasn't as successful as they hoped it would be, because what would happen is whoever had the natural order flow for that option security, he already had the business, and if someone wanted to compete for it, they would come in and they'd have to put their capital at risk and lose money at the beginning with the hope of taking away the order flow. But the response from the guy from the order flow was to drop his fees and make tighter markets. So the guy who's challenging had to follow that down and was losing more money. So in a practical sense, a lot of what the SEC hoped to get and Justice Department hoped to get, they didn't get, but they got some of it.
So different exchanges, like Amex would do most of the market in certain options.
Yes.
And CBOE would do most of the market.
One of our market makers would say, gee, I Apple's hot. Well, Apple wasn't on the Amex, but so-and-so is hot on the Amex, and there's a lot of volume. I'd like to trade that one. And you'd see him, go ahead. No one's going to stop you.
Right.
And SEC and Justice Department alleged that the exchanges collaborated to prevent that competition from going on. And I know it didn't collaborate.
Yeah.
And that may have been because we were the big winner most of the time, but I know we didn't collaborate. But there was one of the exchange heads who was at a meeting in Washington who said, this is long after I'd gone, well, that was all pursuant to the agreement. What agreement he was referring to, I don't know. But so after I left, there were some big changes, but
yeah,
you got to get those from other people.
The Justice Department was interested again.
When I left a memo with our board of directors that said four things basically have to happen that I haven't been able to complete. One, the exchange needs to go electronic. And we have just made an agreement with the Swiss exchange to take their electronic system for free.
Okay.
And it will cost us $1 million to put a GUI on the front. And we will have that system.
A GUI?
And GUI. It's a new it's an interface.
Okay.
It's to take the Swiss interface and change it to American interface.
Gotcha.
And CBOE adapted it.
Okay.
There's a name for the GUI, and I just blanked.
Right.
Anyway, and OCC had a brand new clearing for package. And so the three of us agreed we would take on the Swiss system, and we would market it around the world and in conjunction with OEX with their brand new system, margining system, and then we'd split the profits three ways. And that contract was signed and before the board when I left.
Okay.
But the floor guys were fighting it fiercely. Secondly was you better complete, we were doing a review on competitiveness. I said the Justice Department is got a team put together who are finishing up revolutionizing the NASD. And where are they going to look? Find other competitive market maker systems they think aren't competitive will be the next target, and we better finish that up and make sure everything's right. And thirdly, you're going to have to seriously limit the floor directors dragging their heels, and that may mean a restructure. Anyway, I left those three things, and the new chairman came in, and Bill Brodsky obviously didn't want to fight with the floor. Starts.
Right.
So they let that whole electronic. We would have been electronic. I left in 97. We would have been electronic in 98. there never would have been a competing exchange coming in. And the CBOE now has about a third of the volume instead of 70%.
Right.
It's amazing. But I understand why he didn't want to go ahead. And then the floor directors, once they'd done that, they held their ground. You know, give me two more years with the open outcry.
Right. Well, plus he didn't want to put his head on the block
the first thing.
You know,
yeah.
He wouldn't last very long anyway. The institutional market, one of the things you see during your years is ticking up like 5% every year. Did that just happen, or is that something that the CBOE and the other options exchanges?
Well, we had a marketing team. Retail, we had a options institute, which we created, which continuously gave courses to brokers and customers who wanted to know the retail business. And then we had a small team of people who went out to the institutions.
Okay.
I'd go along occasionally if it was it was CalPERS or someone like that. It seems to have had their star dim lately, but they were the cat's meow back then. And we would go call, or they would go call on the institutions. And the institutions all of a sudden had ways to hedge their portfolio they'd never had before. S&P 500 is their underlying. They can hedge their risk in the S&P 500 option contract. They can increase their exposure much more easily by using that. And then more sophisticated uses guys with the computers started creating entire new uses for the options at the institutional level.
So was CalPERS one of the early big ones?
I wouldn't pick them. I don't know who I'd pick it.
Yeah. You would think once somebody showed that it could be done, that others would.
Everyone heard about it. Everyone knew about it. It was spreading, as you said, 5% a year isn't a very hot growth rate for discovering that.
Yeah, no, it's not too hot, but it's not bad. The other thing.
And remember, we didn't have mutual funds. You know, the first mutual fund was Manhattan Fund, and that was in the 60s. So mutual funds were growing dramatically during that period. They'd had a slow start. And so now you have institutional investors, other than traditional portfolios of tax-exempt organizations, and corporate pension funds are always there, but now you've got mutual funds. And some of them were created to take more risk,
right.
And this is a wonderful vehicle for it.
Something else that you were involved in was, I think you looked at a couple of merger opportunities.
The CBOE?
Yeah.
Well, we went and talked to the New York Stock Exchange because we thought that could make real sense because they didn't have a business. And then they developed a small option business, a good one, but small. And I went and talked to them about getting together, and we ended up buying their option business rather than their wanting to merge. We both organizations saw it very highly of themselves, and so that meant in a merger, each side wants more control than the other, and hopefully New York and Deutsche Börse can figure that out. I don't think they're going to get the deal done. I think the NASDAQ bid probably won't win for NASDAQ, but it's probably broken up the Deutsche Bank deal. Regulators have time to line up their forces. Anyway, so we talked to them. We went and talked to Philadelphia about merging with Philadelphia.
And you came pretty close on that, didn't you?
We came close. But again, there was a feeling in Philadelphia that they didn't want to lose the identity of the Philadelphia Exchange. The community leaders were talking to the people at the exchange saying, look, you're one of the institutions we point to, the historic institutions in our city. You have to have some civic pride here. And all of those things went into the decision not to do it. In terms of trade, we made some very good offers. They wish they'd taken them now. But, you know, all of that went into play. They didn't want to be the Philadelphia division of the CBOE.
Right. Well, we talked a little bit about technology. Anything else we should touch on in the CBOE years?
Well, we became, in my years, we implemented a lot of new technology, which was basically automating the floor, the order delivery systems, with over great resistance. Market makers were allowed to have access to their firms electronically, directly. It was always a fight. They didn't want anyone to be able to contact, get information or on or send it off the floor. So we fought that. We got to put in electronic routing systems. We ran this big data system. And the volume and the computer-generated quotes that are now exist. Have you talked to Ed Joyce at all?
No, I haven't.
He'd be a wonderful person. He's currently the CEO. And Adam's been there from the beginning. But he can give you the current statistics compared to the old statistics, but it's 1,000 times the number of quotes that were going out when I left there. I made that number up, but it's that kind of magnitude. You probably find I understated it. And of course, now they've got an electronic trading system. But that was... We had one that didn't sign the deal. I thought when I left that that's the best thing I'd done in my 11 years at the exchange.
Did you suspect that it would be really difficult to make that happen, though, given the concerns?
I thought I could have made it happen, I didn't know Bill couldn't.
Or would choose not to.
Yeah. But... You know, the two, you know, those guys in New York, the two guys who built the exchange in New York, Gary Katz and, what's the other guy's name? Anyway, when we acquired the New York Stock Exchange, we offered them jobs, but they thought they were low-level jobs, and therefore they turned them down. They were running the New York Stock Exchange option business. And they then created the competitor, and they had a three-year advantage. They were taking away business electronically, and the firms all wanted electronics. And the CBOE lost over half of its market share. It kept all their index business, which was... But on the equity markets there, they don't do any more than the new exchange does.
Well, maybe it took that to convince the floor members that this
was... Yeah, except when...
Did you retire for any period of time then?
I retired in spring. I guess it was around March of 74. I was going to be paid. They paid me through September, which was the end of my contract. And I told them that we were at a time where the issues that were so big needed someone who was going to be there for 10 years and had a vision.
Gotcha.
And could... I didn't see myself at that point in time 10 more years. Now I'd be 97, or 10, you know, I'd be 7 years old almost. So I gave notice, and they noticed, so they said, well, we'll pay you through September when we find the right guy. He'll come on board and you'll get paid to the end of September. So they found the right guy. We had a committee. They got Bill Brodsky, and I, in effect, retired in March. And a good friend of mine who ran the Chicago Corporation, a guy named Jack Wing, who'd been part of a special study, Ralph Saul's right-hand guy, this whole thing keeps going like that, said to me, you know, we've been acquired by AB and AMRO, and he said, they could really use you, we could use you, why don't you come over and join us? So I went over to be the CEO of their financial services company, which had a big series of brokerage offices in Chicago, Illinois, and Michigan. And then to be vice chairman of their capital markets group. They were trying to build a competitive capital markets group, but most of my time was devoted to running a brokerage firm. Hmm. And I did that for 7 years.
Was that LaSalle Bank?
It was LaSalle Bank, which subsequently was acquired by ABN AMRO.
Okay.
And LaSalle had acquired the Chicago Corporation, which was where I went. I joined LaSalle Bank. And
okay.
And that was it. I retired in 2004, and that was the end of my active business career. I said to my bride, where do you want to live now that we're going to retire? I've picked the spots for the last 5 moves. Where do you want to do? Go back to Switzerland or London or New York? And she says, I don't know. And I said, what if you get hit by a bus tomorrow? She said, I'd go home to Little Rock, Arkansas. There we were. We were in Little Rock, which I was... It's a nice place to live. I miss not having things to do every day. I mean, I went almost 50 years with very few vacations, working 60 to 80 hours a week. When I came to the CBOE, a good example of the Wally Out thing, I come in at 7:30. And there's no one there but the cleaning crew. And I'd go up to my office and I'd do things I had to do. And about 8 o'clock, a few people would show up. 8:30, the majority of them showed up. And the general counsel would always show up around 9. And I kept showing up at 7:30. Most of the people caught on. So I finally said, look, let's make it 8 o'clock. And everyone but the general counsel caught on. So I called him in and he said, you know, everyone's figured out that we got to start work at 8 around here. You obviously have missed that. He said, well, I'm the general counsel. Lawyers don't go to work early, they stay late. I said, but you don't stay late. And he looked at me. He said, well, I'm not going to come to work at 8 o'clock. I said, well, that's good. You ought to find some place where you don't have to go to work at 8 o'clock and go find yourself a job. But that was kind of everything was, you know, we had a market that opened at 8:30.
Yeah.
Member firms were on the phone trying to find people to solve problems. Well, I always look back on my early years at the good fortune I had to work for Irv Pollack and Joe Levin, who were our 2 day-to-day bosses, and they were assistant general counsel. Young people could never have found 2 better people. Every lawyer I know who worked there feels the same way. And we were in writing briefs until midnight. Irv was in there with us till midnight. And we'd say, Irv, we need citations for this. He'd say, oh, you've got to call out the numbers of the federal code and or what case it was. And, you know, it was a wonderful atmosphere. And then when I went to work for Funston and Etherington, that was a great environment. But in both environments, I learned to work hard, and I learned a lot of values, which I think really helped me in good stead as I went through my business years. And I think one of the most important lessons I learned is wasn't about me, it was about them, it was about for us. And as I listen to people on the political stage give speeches where it's I and me and all of that, I mean, I find no wonder the place is in a mess. But it was like a big family at the CBOE for 11 years. It was like a big family at Shearson. Everyone, you know, you knew everybody, you knew their dog Spot, you cared about them, and that's the way it was, the people I worked with at the SEC. But that's because our mentors were like that.
Yeah.
So you learn something every manager should earn. you don't do the best for the organization by being a commanding general and dictator and taking credit for everything. In fact, if you take credit for nothing, the work will work better. If you give it to everyone else, it'll work better.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great sentiment to end on. Thank you so much for all
your
time.
Okay. Nice to meet you.